Turn me to the book of Daniel this morning, and we just started into a new series there. If you're having a hard time finding that, it is the 27th book of the Old Testament, so kind of give you a place there. I know sometimes we aren't maybe as familiar with the Old Testament passages, but it is a thrill to be able to study the Old Testament together. What an important part of our understanding of the whole of the story of the gospel, the whole of the story of the Bible by gleaning the Old Testament. Sometimes I've heard people say things like, well, I don't like the Old Testament as much. I like the God of the New Testament, who seems much happier and kinder and nicer than the Old Testament. But that is really just a misunderstanding of the whole of the Bible. There's actually one pastor I heard down in the Georgia area in the last of a mega church that he said, we need to unhitch our Christianity from the Old Testament because it is impeding people from coming to trust in Jesus Christ. But really, that's an unfortunate because or understanding of the Bible, because it is really one story. As the theologian Augustine actually years ago once put it, he said, in the Old Testament, the new is concealed, and in the new, the old is revealed. So really what we have is the revelation of God's purpose and plan throughout the scriptures that way. So we're in the book of Daniel, and Daniel is really an exciting book. And we started this last week in chapter 1. Again, we're going to be kind of hitting this in a little bit of a quicker pace, more of an overview. But we come to Daniel chapter 2, and really the plan of God's grace, the plan of Jesus Christ, is probably no better prophetically laid out for us than in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Now, we often think of great prophecy, and we think of the book of Revelation. But Revelation is dependent upon the book of Daniel, specifically in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. In this, a prophecy that spans for us the time from the time of Daniel from 600 BC, 600 years before Christ, up until the final second advent, the second coming of Jesus Christ to set up his kingdom and authority. And so there's a vision and or a dream and an interpretation of this dream that is critical for us in understanding the biblical plan for God and the nations. And so we're going to be jumping into that the next 2 weeks here. And remember, Daniel is so uniquely placed in this time period. Daniel, the character, the individual. God has placed him in Babylon. He's just come through what might be referred to as the Ivy League, the University of Babylon, and graduated summa cum laude at the top of, I think that's what that's called, the top of his class. The highest marks there in his class. But it also tells us in chapter 1 and verse 17, not only did David get from God and God granted them grace and understanding, he gave them knowledge and skill in all literature, it says in verse 17 of chapter 1, and wisdom, but Daniel also had understanding in all visions and dreams. That is an important statement as it's going to transfer into chapter 2. An interesting point I meant to say last week that I didn't get a chance to, or I missed it. As I think about Daniel and his three friends graduating from this Babylonian public school education, there is sometimes a lot of discussion amongst families and individuals regarding public school versus Christian school versus homeschool. I would say they all have incredible merit. And what I found interesting is that as Daniel and his three friends graduate here, they never lost their spiritual fervor for God. What that tells me is it is not mandatory that the schooling system is determinative of their spiritual desire for God. Right? So kids can come out of public school education, Christian school education, and homeschool education and have a spiritual fervor for God. But I want to just give two caveats to that. one, for Daniel and his three friends to come out with that same spiritual fervor, it is explicitly clear that he had a foundation that was deeply rooted in a walk with God. Not only by his name, which was all four of their names depicted different characteristics of God and his faithfulness, but also by the fact that he was very quite capable of acknowledging and understanding that which would defile him. Laws, even dietary laws, and he had committed himself to obedience to the Lord. That was something that's taught. He was taught that from a child. So in no matter what schooling system that is, that training to have a spiritual fervor for God must be taught in the home. Second of all, as just a kind of also an observation and somewhat of a warning, is it is interesting to note that only four people stood, right? Only four guys end up standing at the end of the day. The rest all assimilated into the rest of the Chaldean system with no concern about that. Now, I'm not saying there's a statistical number or something that is guaranteed there, but it is interesting how many others, and we don't know how many others came from Jerusalem up to Babylon that did get assimilated into Babylon. And so there's some thoughts for you as parents are considering what schooling system and where to go with your children. Again, I don't think any of them are determinative. I don't think putting them in a Christian school is determinative. I don't think homeschooling is determinative of where they're going to be at with their walk with God when they leave your home. It requires much home vigilance and training. Now, we come back to Daniel chapter 2 here, and we find really this narrative builds for us, and it sets the stage for this this revelation of this prophecy. Now, Daniel chapter 2 is 49 verses long, and I recognize we're wanting to move in more holistic compounds here. However, that's a bit much. And so what we're going to do is we're going to break down chapter 2 into 2 weeks. And we're going to look at verses 1 through 30, really build for us the narrative of how did this dream and this interpretation come about? How did this prophecy that spans for us now over 26 centuries and tells for us the coming of Jesus Christ again, how did that come to be? And interestingly enough, that this prophecy is revealed or is given in a dream to a pagan king. This isn't given to a Israeli king or one of the kings of the southern tribe of Judah. But what's interesting I want to highlight this morning is two clear different core systems. Two clear different core beliefs and programs as which, when they're going through a crisis, what are they trusting in? Contrasting Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian system and all of his wise men and their core system of where they're finding their strength and their security and what they're trusting in contrast to Daniel and his three friends as they face this crisis. A crisis in which they're being threatened to be executed and their houses burned to the ground. And how does he stand through that? How does he stand when the crisis of life, when situations of life seem ominous and difficult? Your core of what you truly believe becomes evident in those times. So we're gonna kind of contrast and lay those two side by side. What does the world system, the Chaldean Babylonian system of their core beliefs versus that of Daniel and his three friends who pursued God? And so the question really for us is, what is central to your life that you might handle crisis and situations right? Well, let's have a word of prayer and then we'll look at that together. Father, I pray this morning as we gather that you'd give us wisdom and understanding into your word. Lord, as we are clearly identifying and seeing the application and the practical nature of the book of Daniel to our lives today, Lord, help us that we would develop more and more to become like Daniel's. Lord, that we would have a courageous faith. or do we have a substantive, deep-rooted system in you? So, Father, I pray that you would guide our time this morning for your glory's sake. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's look at the first one, which would be the frustration of a man-centered power. Now, the stage is going to be set so perfectly and dramatically for Daniel in the first 13 verses here. And so it begins and says, now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Stop there for a moment. I recognize that to those who are astute as we're reading through, you're saying, wait a minute, how can this be the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign when Daniel's three friends just went through 3 years of training? And there are some who read that and they say, well, we must have a textual discrepancy or an error in the text, and so therefore we've got a problem with God's word. It's actually not. Let me give you what is really the simplest and easiest understanding of this, why this is not an error. Because the Babylonian understanding of the years of the kings dated differently than we might think. They don't count your first partial year as your first year of being a king. So, to put it kind of the time frame, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem and took Daniel's three friends in the early part of the spring, probably May, June time of the year in 605 BC. And then at that point, his father was still alive for just a short period. At that point then, Daniel and his three friends probably start early summer. They start into their 3 years of training process. Nebuchadnezzar now assumes the throne. However, they don't count that as part of his year. And they go off a different calendar year. So he would start his first year of being a king in the next spring. So they've gone through almost a year of training by the time they're going to count him as being the king. So he is in his second year, wrapping up his second year of being king, when Daniel and his three friends have already finished their 3 years of training, and now this vision comes to be. So, again, it comes down to that understanding of Babylonian understanding of the times of the kings. So, with that being said then, here's what takes place. First thing we see is, we're going to label as the king's limited peace. It says, so during the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. And the king gave him the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. So it starts out with Nebuchadnezzar having a rough night's sleep and having troubling dreams. Have you ever had that? Have you ever had a night where you're like, man, my dreams have been all over the place? How many of you have any sleepwalkers in your house? We have some on occasion that we have them, some will sleepwalk. We had one that, this was a few years back, we were at our last house that we were living in, and my wife and I were up still reading, and our door opened to our room, and the kids' bedroom was down this way, and all of a sudden we see one of our kids walk by our room, and this is about 11 o'clock at night, walk by our room and go down the stairs. I'm thinking, what are they doing at 11 o'clock at night? So I got up, and I went downstairs after them, and there we had at the kitchen island, there was a little seating and bar area, and I see my daughter sitting at the kitchen island just staring straight ahead. So I'm like, this is kind of weird. And I said to her, I said, what are you doing? And she, and you know how when they're like half asleep, the talking doesn't make sense? And I said, I think you just need to go to bed. It's not time for breakfast yet. Why don't you go back to bed? So she's like, okay. So she gets down off the stool, and instead of heading back up the stairs, she heads out the garage, like out the door to the garage. And I was like, whoa. Let's head up this way. This is the direction to your room, right? So the reality is we have unique dreams at different times. I'm going to tell one more. How many of you have woken up in the morning and you're convinced somebody did something wrong to you, and you're angry at your spouse because in your dream In your dream, they did something mean to you. I am not the recipient of the dreams. I am in someone else's dream. And it takes me half the day to convince my spouse, I didn't do that. Like what you dreamt about, it wasn't me. I am good. I am kind. Like that isn't me. Like, has that ever happened to anybody? Yes. Okay, good. So Nebuchadnezzar understands that. Like he's had some rough dreams. And interestingly enough, it says, it refers to them in the plural. It says that Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, plural. Later on, he's going to ask, I want you to tell me an interpretation of the dream. So I think what it is I think Nebuchadnezzar kind of started having this dream. It's very vivid, very real, and it woke him up. And then he does what the rest of us do when we're having strange nights of dreams. We go get another piece of pizza from the fridge, and then he goes back to sleep, expecting that dream will go away, I'll have another dream. But the same dream comes back up. And he's seeing the same thing. And it is so vivid, so ominous, so clear, and it keeps on happening over and over again throughout that night that he is just shaken. What is this dream about? It is too vivid. Now, possibly also it's just the weight of being the king of the largest empire in the world at that time. And as Shakespeare said, heavy lies the head that wears the crown. It's just the worries and the cares. What does this mean? What does this dream mean for me as king? What does this dream mean as relates to our kingdom here? There's always this concern as a king of, is this all on a fragile line? Does this whole thing collapse at any moment? And so he knows this dream is very important, somehow very ominous. And he senses something is wrong, but he doesn't have the interpretation, so he doesn't know what it means to him. And so all of a sudden, his peace is gone. So he calls in all of his magicians, sorcerers, astrologers, and Chaldeans. And he tells them he has had a dream, and he's very anxious about it, and he wants them to tell him it. So that moves to our next group, which is the Chaldeans and their limited power. So these guys come in, and notice what they say in verse 4. The Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, which was the language of the Babylonians at that time. Interestingly enough, a large portion of Daniel is actually recorded for us in Aramaic, in the original language. But they record, O king, live forever, tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Right? You tell us what happened, and we'll figure it out. Right? We'll tell you what's going on here. We'll tell you what to do. The king's like, no. That isn't the plan. He says, I want you to tell me the dream and the interpretation. Now, we aren't exactly sure why that is. Possibly, and in some translations even will state it in verse 5, King answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. Some translations have it here is the thing is gone from me. Some other translations translate that the decree is firm that has gone from me. And so the question is did he remember the dream? And he's testing them and seeing whether they actually know what they're talking about. Possibly he's been around long enough with watching his dad with these guys and now as king, and he doesn't trust these guys. You guys have just been blowing smoke for the last years, and maybe he doesn't trust them. I think it's more so that he knows what the dream is, and the decree that he's given out is firm. He's made up his mind. You tell me the dream, and you tell me the interpretation, and if you don't, he says, if you don't make the dream known to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall maybe made an ash heap. However, if you do tell me the dream, its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. And so, again, I think there's a little bit of a skepticism. He's testing them. But what's interesting is these Chaldeans did have a very methodical dream reading system. You say, what is that? Well, they had this These guys were smart because in their trust, their core was, let's intellectually decipher everything. We can intellectually figure anything out. So what they would do is they had an interesting methodology of tracking dreams. You would tell them your dream, and then they would track the next portion of your life to see, when you have this kind of a dream, what happens next. And they had vast libraries. In fact, archaeological studies and discoveries have found these dream manuals. And so they would then say, okay, you had this type of a dream, had some of these elements in it, so therefore this has got to be what this interpretation is going to mean. And so in their estimation is, you tell us this dream, and we intellectually, because that's where our core is, that's where our confidence is, that's where our faith is, we can figure this out. But there was a hinge to that. The hinge was they had to know what the dream was. And he says, no, I want you to tell me the dream. So when the king says that, their response again in verse 7 was, well, let the king tell his servants the dream and we'll give his interpretation. Like they repeat their same statement. You've got to tell us the dream so that we can tell you the interpretation. Well, at that point, he's getting angry. So the king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there's only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. See, that's what I think he's saying. This is already planned out. You guys just make this stuff up. Like, this isn't, you already decided if I tell you the dream, you can figure that out. And it's kind of like, it's kind of like those who are the self-proclaimed psychics and palm readers. They'll ask some inquisitive questions about your life, and then they'll give you this vague answer that could almost fit every situation. You're going to have something special happen to you in the near future, and no one else is going to understand it but you. Wow. It could be anything, right? I mean, and he's like, I've seen this kind of baloney all my life. I'm not buying it. If you guys are the real deal, if you're really the ones who speak to the gods and have the authority of that, you tell me what's going on. If not, you're going to get hacked to pieces, and I'm going to burn your houses down. Like, there was no gray area, and they're like, well, we just need a little time. No. I knew you'd ask for more time. You're not having it. I knew you'd come in and speak lying and corrupt words till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. Their response is very acknowledging of their inability. The Chaldeans answered in the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It's a difficult thing that the king requests. There is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. And for this reason, the king was very angry and very furious, and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So they basically just self-incriminate themselves, and they admit their limitations. They acknowledge, we don't have that ability. Nor do our gods. The king's command was beyond what their gods could do. It would take a god of a different god, a god who's, as he said, as verse 11, a God whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. And so they acknowledge that. In fact, Daniel even highlights that in verses 27 and 28 as he separates the revelation from his God in contrast to those gods. He says, the secret which the king has demanded the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers, that they cannot declare the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. And he has made known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what will be in the latter days. And so, the only place you're going to read the future is in the Bible when God gives it. There is no hope in calling 1-900 psychics. There is no hope in going to a palm reader. They have no answers because they do not know the God who reveals secrets. And what God wants you to know has been revealed in His Word. And so I think that's important for us to understand there. They have a limited ability and a limited power. And so the king has a limited peace because he's wondering, how do I keep all this kingdom together? And he's trying to do it all by his own strength, his own abilities. These Chaldeans, their core is their own intellect, their own abilities. And they're all of a sudden realizing there's a limit to that. That's not working. Well, that leads to then, obviously, the king's limited patience. We just read some of that as he was very angry. He's really angry. He gives the command to gather them up and to cut them in pieces and to make their homes a pile of ash and rubble. That's not entirely uncommon for ancient leaders of the East, ancient rulers of the East, to be notoriously temperamental. They had almost unrestricted authority and power. They could do what they want, but they also trusted very little. And so this was not unheard of, but it's also somewhat foolish. It's a reaction. You can see the response, the reaction. When your core of your faith and your confidence breaks down, you go into panic mode. You get into anger and frustration. You go into demolition mode. I am going to destroy all this stuff. So there's where these cores are. Here's this first side that we're seeing is this core of a man-centered power. I'm going to control it by my strength. I'm the king. I'm the king of Babylon. And I've got these wise men's, their core has been, we're going to trust in the stars, or we're going to trust in our own intellect and these dream books and all these things. But all of a sudden, when that is tested and it becomes reality that when a crisis hits, that this core isn't sufficient to carry you through because it's not substantive, all of a sudden, you go into panic. All of a sudden, you get angry. All of a sudden, everything starts breaking down. Okay, so there's this one side. Well, that sets the stage perfectly for unramping Daniel. Daniel, who we are told in chapter 1 and verse 8, that had purposed himself not to defile himself, his heart. He's going to follow God. He's going to pursue God. So then, now, let's move from there. What is the contrast that moves from that worldly core to now this core that is a God-centered people? The revelation of a God-centered people. And now we remember that Daniel and his three friends are included in this death decree. They're not exempted from this decree that goes out to gather up all the wise men and to kill them. And that they're beginning to kill them. And so they sought out, it says at the end of verse 13, Daniel and his companions to kill them. He's got a death decree on his head. The crisis is just as real for him. But what does a God follower look like in this situation? What is his core? So maybe we could frame it as a question. What characterizes a God-centered person in a time of crisis? What are things that we notice of Daniel in this? Well, the first thing you're going to notice is he responds with a different peace. All the rest of the guys decreed to be killed are in turmoil and panic, but he possesses a different calmness and peace. Now, he wasn't in there with the king. He didn't have the opportunity to talk to the king when he pulled in all the other wise men, possibly and probably, because you got to remember, he's still probably only about 18 years of age. He's a young guy, just gone through his training. He's also still a foreigner, right? And so the king doesn't necessarily trust him yet to the same level. He's kind of, building up that, but so he's not there. And so he finds out, and even though his life is on the line, he trusts in God's sovereign care and will. And instead of reacting in panic and exasperation as if it all depends on his strength and his intellect and wisdom, he calmly responds. So as Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, this would be the guy that's the captain of the soldiers to do all the execution. And interestingly to me, By the way, note who it is that ends up coming to for Daniel. It's not just some random guy. It ends up being Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. Like, this is the highest guy. God even ordains the steps of access to the king by bringing Arioch to him. God's hand is in all of this for the man of God. But he comes, and notice it says, and then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch. What a different perspective. With counsel and wisdom. And so he answered, as Arioch is there, and he's asking Arioch, he says, why is the decree from the king so urgent? And Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. Arioch pauses and actually answers, and they're having this dialogue, and Daniel is acting with calmness. He's not trying to fight back against Arioch. He's speaking with wisdom and counsel. This guy's making sense. He's not hyper or angrily arguing with Arioch. And he rather seeks future or further clarification of the facts. It's amazing how that can settle things down sometimes. We tend to get sometimes whipped up in a situation before we even know what the situation is about. But he has a peace. He has a calmness. God is the one who leads the steps of my life. The steps of a good man, Psalm 37:23, are ordered by the Lord. He delights in his way. He has a calmness to understand, God, you're going to take care of my steps. So what's this situation about? He just asks some great questions. Daniel wisely gets more information. And we see God orchestrating this. But notice, so Daniel then goes in before the king. Interestingly enough, Arioch, who was sent to kill Daniel, actually now arranges for him to have a meeting with the king. That's astounding in itself. Here's this 18-year-old guy, a foreigner. He's not built up the credibility of the other magi. And yet, he says, well, I'd like to talk to the king. And Arioch says, yeah, I can arrange it. Because Daniel, you're speaking sense. Something here that you're talking about makes sense. I'll make sure that you can talk to the king. Because if Arioch brought in some whippersnapper who was just going to blow smoke and yell back at the king, Arioch would have been possibly have his own neck on the line. That tells you Daniel is approaching this very differently. Where Arioch says, yeah, I'll bring this guy in. So he brings Daniel before the king. And so he goes in. And again, we don't find him irate or exasperated fighting with the king. But rather, notice what it says. He went and he asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. So his request is, King, I'd like some time so I can tell you the interpretation. Now, wait a minute. Think about this. What was it that the king refused for the rest of the wise men? Time. You can't have any more time. I knew you'd ask for more time because you don't know the answer. So get out of here. The decree is made. You're going to be all killed. Yet Daniel comes in. He asks for time. And the king gives him time. Why is that? Why does the king do that? Possibly because he already has seen there's a distinction between Daniel and his friends. Or Daniel and the rest of the magi. This guy has a God that we don't talk to. Something's unique here, and I'd like to hear what he has to say. Possibly that's it. Possibly it also has to do with Daniel's approach. The Chaldeans seem somewhat like, King, this is ridiculous. Like they almost call the king out. I don't sense that Daniel's approach is that way. I sense he comes with respect, he comes with the right attitude, coming before the king, and so the king gives him time. What a difference there. You know, it's interesting, the different peace that you have when you know God is orchestrating your steps. And in that heart of peace, how you're able to then think wisely, think calmly, and respond rightly. When your core is God is in control of all of my life, your responses are very different. It was George Whitefield who wisely used to say, we are immortal until our work on earth is done. Well, that moves then to the next characteristic, which is that of prayer. So he gets dismissed from the king. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret. So they go back to the house, and he gathers up the guys. He says, hey guys, listen, here's what's going on. We got to pray. So here are these teenage guys start to seek the Lord of mercy, that he might reveal to them this secret. And that word is interesting. It's used 8 times, the word secret, in this chapter. It's equivalent to the Greek word mysterion in the New Testament, or mystery, a thing meaning a thing that's hidden until it's revealed by God. But it's interesting. They don't take this time when they have a little extra time and they go back to their house. They don't say, hey guys, listen, we got a little extra time here. Let's figure out an escape plan. Let's figure out how we can get out of town, right? The executioners are going to come back, and if we don't have something figured out, if we don't get out of here, our lives are over. They also don't come up with, let's just try to figure out some sort of strategy of how we can make up something that would sound like a reasonable dream and a reasonable interpretation, and maybe we can fog this over on the king. Rather, we find them on their knees. God, we are begging mercy from you. You're the God who reveals secrets. God, you've placed us here. You want us in this situation. Would you reveal what the next step is for us? One unknown author once wisely stated, prayer is our highest privilege, our gravest responsibility, and the greatest power God has put into our hands. Prayer, real prayer, is the noblest, the sublimest, the most stupendous act that any creature of God can perform. So here you have these guys, and I see this in my mind of them gathered in their living room on their knees, fully believing that God was able to answer their prayer and could reveal this if he chose. So instead of panic in the crisis, they prayed. I would also just add one more thing that we don't see here, but we do find other places. Attached to prayer sometimes when you're going through crisis is the wise aspect of fasting. For instance, we see that with Esther and Mordecai just shortly thereafter in the situation. And you see before she goes before the king that they all fast and pray. And there is a wisdom to taking the time when serious crises are going on in your lives to fast and put aside physical needs to focus on spiritual things and really be imploring from God. God, I don't even want to seek after physical things right now. My heart is so focused on you and these spiritual things. And there's an aspect that we should be prayer warriors involving fasting in our lives as well. Again, we don't see that in this text here, but we do see that throughout many times in the scriptures. So through that time of prayer, God answered, verse 19, God answers their prayer. The secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And then that moves to then the third response of a core that's God-centered is that of praise. His response then in end of verse 19 was, so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He's quick to give God the glory that he is due. And then he writes a hymn. Verses 20 through 23 are a hymn of praise. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things, and he knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. So it really almost as James said, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and it'll be granted him. They asked of this wisdom. They asked for God to reveal, and God gave it. So he sings a praise to God. And then moves to thanksgiving in verse 23. It's interesting there. God, you're the God who you can do anything. Notice the core again. Notice the core of what they stand on, what they believe about their God. Wisdom and might are yours. You can change the times and the seasons. You're the one who removes kings and raises up kings. Like, this is all orchestrated by you. God, you are sovereign. See their core? You see what the substance of their faith is? So when crisis comes, it can't dismantle that. It can't remove that. It only reveals it. It reveals what you stand on. And then he starts in thanksgiving, verse 23, I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. An interesting statement there, O God of my fathers. Because that statement, which is used repeatedly in the Old Testament, is a statement that points back. It points back to God of our fathers who brought us out of Egypt, who protected us and supplied for us in the wilderness, who gave us victory over Og, king of Bashan, and goes on and on. You read throughout the scriptures this aspect of our God of our fathers has always been faithful. When you're going through times of crisis, it is so important that we look back. This week I was praying over some things at my home and had some things that was kind of making me a little anxious. And then God reminded me in my prayer time of, look back, Greg. Look back on my past care and provision and ability. Has there ever been a lack there? And as I look back, it resolved those things in my heart. And I went to a meeting that I had, and I was talking with some other pastors, and I was talking about that. And they said, yeah, you know, I had the same thing happen this week. And it reminded me of, one of them was telling about his dad, who was a pastor in the past. And he said, my dad used to say, it's so important for Christians to have a Romans faith. I thought, what do you mean by a Romans faith? I didn't think they had much faith. He said, no, not the Romans, the people that were, you know, the kingdom, but a Roman in a boat. As you rowed a boat, like as a crew or a scully, where you're directing where you're going by looking backwards. If you've ever rowed in a boat like that, you don't keep looking like this. You direct where you're going by looking where you've already come from. There's an aspect of wisdom to our faith when crisis comes to say, God, as I look back, I'm going to keep rowing because you've already brought me through all of that. You've taken care of me every step of the journey. And your faith is strong in crisis and is encouraged by looking back. And that's why I think of that phrase, O God of my fathers. Now you've given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we have asked of you. And so there is a praise. A God-centered life will be a worshipful life. The third thing is, interestingly enough, is people. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, verse 24 and 25 is interesting. It says, and Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. It's interesting to me, when your core is in tune with God, that there's also a horizontal concern for people. It's just a natural outpouring of that. Daniel could have easily let the killings go on. Let me have all the rest of the magi and the wise men be executed. It'll be less that I've got to compete with in the future. I can rise to the top and not have anybody else I'm fighting with. He doesn't do that. He says, hey, Arioch, stop this killing these men. Let them live. And then he says, I'll go in and tell the king what exactly is going on. And then it's interesting, as Arioch goes in verse 25, it says, he quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah, who will make known to the king the interpretation. Actually, a key strong word in there is, I have found. Like, I know you want to give out a reward, right, King Nebuchadnezzar, to, if anybody could tell your dream and the interpretation, hey, I'm part of this, right? I found this guy that will do it for you. You want to promote me a little bit? There's a little bit of sticking his nose in there. But Daniel doesn't correct that. He doesn't concern himself with that. But again, I see that heart for people. But then lastly, we see in this God-centered core is a right perspective. A right perspective. He comes in before the king, and the king doesn't waste any time. He goes right to the question. Can you tell me the dream and the interpretation? You better bring it. And Daniel beautifully responds, setting the matter in its proper light and giving God the glory. Notice how he does this in verse 27 and 28. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king." They cannot answer it. Why? Because they don't have a God-centered wisdom. They're not connected to the God who reveals secrets. So it was unable for them to do it. He says, "But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. And he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days." God is revealing to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, what the prophecy of what is coming until the coming of Jesus Christ in the latter days. And he's given it to you because the God of heaven is sovereignly in control of all that. What Daniel does first is he separates. He makes a distinction. The God that I seek after and that I follow and that I get my responses from is not the gods of all your other guys. This isn't some dream make or dream casting methodology. This is me and my God, the God who reveals secrets. And so he makes a distinction there that of what is going on. And then Daniel proceeds to tell him that this dream is going to be that which is going to span centuries. It's going to reveal what is going to come in the latter days. But then before he reveals the dream, which we're going to get to next week, Daniel is so humble. Look at verse 30. "But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes, who make known the interpretation of the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart." Daniel says, "I don't deserve any credit for this. It isn't because I am smarter than your wise men. It isn't because I'm more worthy than the rest of them." He humbles himself and he says, "This is all about God. God has chosen to show mercy to me. For our lives were on the line, but God's going to take care of us. We prayed and God answered. And, King, because he is choosing to reveal to you something. He's chosen to let you reveal, or have me reveal, the thoughts of your heart." What a humble perspective as he pushes all the credit to God. When your core is, God is sovereign, God is over it all. When God does amazing things, the right response is, "Well, that was God. God provided this need. God directed our steps. God answered this prayer request. God did this." That's the difference of the cores. That's the difference between Nebuchadnezzar, who was, his core was might, power. "I will dominate the world, and I will conquer every other people." But all of a sudden, something becomes so ominous and bigger than him, he doesn't know what to do. All the Chaldeans and the wise men and all these astrologers, "We're going to trust the stars, we're going to trust our navigational things that we've coursed and charted over years. Our intellect will carry us through." But when all of a sudden that becomes insufficient, they say, "Man, we don't know what to do." The king's angry, he's frustrated, he's worried, and all of a sudden their lives are on the line. Contrasted to a God-centered faith. Peace, prayer. There is a whole different perspective and that he carries into this. And so the question comes down to is, what's at the core of your being? Because there's going to come days when the crisis hits. Are you prepared for the crisis? One of the things that's been intriguing to me is I like pictures of, and I like thinking through castles and walled cities, and to think through what have they done to protect themselves for when the siege occurs. And it's interesting, in a lot of the ancient castles and these cities, they discover that there has to be a deep well inside the walls. Because when the pressure and the siege and all that presses from the outside, if your water source is coming from outside, that can get cut off very quickly, and all of a sudden you're dried up and you're hopeless. But if your water source is on the inside and they can't get to that, no outside pressure can conquer you. It can't collapse your walls. It can't cause you to quit. It can't cause you to say, we're just all going to die. Because there's a deep well. I think that same aspect and analogy fits when we think about our core, the inside of the walls of your life is the core of what you have your confidence in, your sustainment in. Is it something from the outside? Or is it God on your inside? That's the difference. Next week, we're going to see this break down and really look at a key prophecy. When is Christ coming back? What did God do in that leading up to that? And so we're going to see that dream be revealed and the interpretation of it next Sunday. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for your word this morning and for giving us insight to understand and see the distinction between the king and his system and philosophy and his core, in contrast to Daniel and his three friends and their core being centered around you. Father, I pray that you'd help us, that we would strengthen that core, that we would, like Daniel, look back on what you've done and who you are, and that we would strengthen that and dig that well down deeper to you, so that when the outside pressures do come, when the sieges do happen, that our walls aren't penetrated. We don't lose our peace. We walk with you in prayer. Father, that we would respond with praise and concern for people. So, Lord, I just pray that you would help us to search our hearts. What's the core of who we are? Thank you for being our God. It's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen.